to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with one of the country's leading intelligence and national security reporters, Walter Pincus, who covers the intelligence community for the Washington Post. And he has won the Polk Award, the Emmy, and Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. And he recently covered the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on the pre-war intelligence, the use of pre-war intelligence concerning Iraq and Al-Qaeda, the so-called Phase 2. We'll be looking into what happened to Phase 2, a lot of which has been postponed till after the election. You recall sometime back the Senate was shut down in a maneuver by the Democrats. So we were looking into that, plus the other senatorial showdown that's coming down this week between the president and a group of defectors from the Republican Party, Senators McCain, Susan Collins, and John Warner, and Lindsey Graham, in terms of their objections to the president's trying to immunize himself and his administration from prosecution, both on FISA and on the War Crimes Act. We'll be talking with Glenn Greenwald, who's a constitutional lawyer who writes for Salon.com. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, How Would a Patriot Act? And he'll be joined by Martin Lederman, who's a visiting professor at the Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches constitutional law. He's a former attorney advisor at the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel, and he's written extensively questions relating to executive power, detention, interrogation, and torture. So we'll be talking to those two gentlemen about the showdown in the Senate. And then we'll speak with Max Blumenthal, who's a Nation Institute Puffin Foundation writing fellow, and he also writes for the American Prospect and the Washington Monthly. And recently, he did a major expose of the right-wing path to ABC's Path to 9/11, in which he revealed details about this cabal who snookered ABC into airing on primetime a $40 million propudrama, which was designed to help the Republican Party 2 months prior to a national election and pin 9/11 on Bill Clinton. Excuse me. I'm now speaking with Walter Pincus, who, as I mentioned, is one of the country's leading national security correspondents. He covers the intelligence community for the Washington Post, and he's won a number of prizes, including the Polk Award, an Emmy, and the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. And he's also been covering recently the Senate Select Intelligence Committee's release of the Phase 2 report, a partial release of the Phase 2 report, on the use of pre-war intelligence concerning Iraq and Al-Qaeda. And, of course, we recall, Walter Pincus, that the Senate was shut down in an unusual parliamentary maneuver that the Democrats conducted, apparently in frustration, at the stonewalling of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee Chair Pat Roberts. So is this the best that they can do in terms of a compromise? Much of the report's been delayed, or the findings have been delayed till after the election, and essentially what they've released is that they forced the administration to admit that there was no connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda.
Well, it's the first of five sections, the first two. One directed at comparing the pre-war intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction to what they found out afterward. And the second, dealing with the Iraqi National Congress, Ahmed Chalabi's group, and the intelligence that was provided by people that Chalabi's group presented primarily to the Pentagon. It was handled through the Defense Intelligence Agency. And both of them support things we knew, but it's the details that make the difference. And the details in this give us more information, because we did know before that the CIA did not feel there was a connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and certainly no connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, although it was an issue that the administration cleverly put forward, and the vice president in particular raised and to some degree still raises. So in that sense, it was useful.
Well, of course, the fact that the president and the vice president have raised this on a number of occasions translates into a substantial number of the population. I think the percentage has gone down, but it may well be as high as 50% of the American people still make this connection, don't they?
We did a poll at the Washington Post within, I think, 4 or 5 months of 9/11, and at that point it was something above 75%. I think we've done it more recently, and it's around the 50% mark. It's still an amazing... People believe their president in this country, no matter how much people question what he's done.
And recently he's actually gone up in the polls.
Once you reinforce the fear of terrorism, which is such a kind of mindless thing and makes people think just walking down the street, no matter where they are, they're in danger. Once you pull on that string, you can. The American public is not used to being afraid, and they don't like it. And every time you pull that string, they support whoever is in power, threatening to do something about it.
But intelligence, as always, I thought, was considered to be off the table in terms of political partisanship, to the extent to which it's supposed to be value-free. Otherwise, it doesn't work. If you can't tell the difference between rhetoric and reality, you may well go the way of the Soviet Union. So what happened to the intelligence, Senate Select Intelligence Committee, because it was set up to try and avoid partisanship with a co-chair that's almost has as much influence, not quite, but you know, there's been a sense from the beginning that was the purpose of the committee, was to give oversight, not political spin.
The Senate committee in particular, the House committee has had a more checkered career. The Senate committee was set up so that the Democratic member is not just the ranking member, he's the vice chairman. And he can try to initiate things, but again and again, the committee has to vote on them. So the majority is still Republican. It began to drift into politics, if I had to pick a date, toward the end of the Clinton administration. You have to remember that when Senator Shelby of Alabama was chairman, the one second-term Clinton appointee that didn't make it was the president's choice for the head of the CIA, and that had to be withdrawn. Tony Lake, who was the National Security Advisor, and therefore was replaced by George Tenet, who then stayed on for 7 years. But the denial of the head of CIA to Tony Lake was the only second-term Clinton appointee turned down. And from then on, Senator Shelby used that committee in what people began to think was a partisan way. It is, since Senator Roberts has taken over, and particularly the fight on the pre-war intelligence, that has become a straight political fight.
So what have we learned? I mean, I believe there is a... if you go to the Senate Intelligence website, which is an intelligence.senate.gov/phase2, which is iiaccuracy.pdf, you can also go to the Democratic Additional Views. But what have we learned?
Well, if you look at that very closely, I wrote a piece the other day about it, and it's another piece in the works. And one of the key Democratic senators had pointed it out to me. If you look at the way they structured their additional views, they in fact have put down the facts as it's been shown by the intelligence, and then put right with it the statements pre-war by the administration. And that was supposed to be the sum and substance of the infamous Part 2 of the investigation they're now on. That is one of the three remaining sections they can't reach agreement on. And so the Democrats, in effect, put their version of it into their separate views of this report.
But in terms of what's being delayed till after the elections, is that about... how Chalabi managed to have so much influence, particularly over the speech that Colin Powell now regrets he made to the United Nations, the use of curveball, the genesis of the Niger forgeries. Is this? Are we ever going to learn about the true stories behind this?
Well, I think taking those separately, the Chalabi part is pretty well outlined in the Iraqi National Congress section. Up to a point, and that is, it describes in quite detail five of the Chalabi supplied informants and the disinformation, intelligence information that was provided by them. But it also makes the finding that almost none of that, the Republicans make the finding, almost none of that found their way into the national intelligence estimate. What's missing from that is another of the still outstanding parts of the Senate inquiry, which is the effect of the Doug Feith Pentagon special intelligence activity that took place parallel to what was going on within the community. And I think you're going to find in that case the information that this investigation shows was questionable, that didn't get into the national intelligence estimate, actually got into the White House and into the Vice President's office. And it was from there that a draft went of Powell's speech. And some of what was in that draft did go into the final speech. A lot of it was taken out.
And the other two, the genesis of the Niger documents, for example?
That's still being investigated, although it's pretty well the original forged documents we don't quite know yet. There are a lot of explanations of that out there. That's, quote, still under investigation by the FBI. And then the final sort of major one, which I have doubts we will ever see, is supposed to be a committee version of the pre-war intelligence and how it was characterized by administration. And then, thanks to the Republicans, also Democratic senatorial and House member statements.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Walter Pincus, who covers national security affairs for the Washington Post, and we're talking about the Senate Select Intelligence Committee's release of two of the five parts of their so-called Phase 2 investigation into the use of intelligence prior to the war in Iraq. But in a broader sense, Walter Pincus, it seems that intelligence reform itself, the director of national intelligence, John Negroponte, who after all succeeded Bremer in Iraq, and Iraq effectively went south on his watch, it seems that he's brought, instead of bringing national intelligence, it's just nothing but turf wars. And I understand that the counterterrorism center over there in McLean is something of a white elephant.
Well, one of the things that always was a problem with the so-called reform is that a lot of people never expected it to happen, including the White House. And it was only after the president was embarrassed, having won re-election, that the so-called reform was sort of hung up in Congress that he began to push it through. I think probably the ugly truth about the reform, which started with the 9/11 Commission, was that it was a bureaucratic reform. Reorganization is a bureaucratic reform, and the failures of pre-9/11 and Iraq were not bureaucratic. Terrorism, to a degree, was bureaucratic because the CIA and the FBI did not exchange information because of what they felt was a legal barrier, which had been fixed with the Patriot Act. But in fact, you could have gotten along very well with giving additional powers to the CIA director, using his role as director of Central Intelligence, and done the same thing. You have a whole new level. Negroponte's staff is now 1,700 people. It is another layer, and that does cause bureaucratic problems. So you have to sort of wait and see what happens.
But this has allowed the Pentagon to sort of forge ahead independently, and they've got the counterintelligence field activity.
The Pentagon forged ahead and would have forged ahead no matter what, because it has clearly got more money and can get more money out of Congress than any other branch of government when you are fighting a so-called war. And with a defense secretary as aggressive as Donald Rumsfeld, who feels and who explored intelligence in the pre-Bush II period, and actually I think was in line to become director of Central Intelligence rather than Secretary of Defense, when Bush's first choice vanished, had his eye on intelligence to begin with. And so he has pumped it up. He created, as you said, which I've written quite a bit about, the counterintelligence field activity, which now has more agents domestically with three services and its own investigators as the FBI working on terrorism inside the United States. He also has created Northern Command, whose job it is to be available to fight terrorism inside this country. So the Pentagon is gearing up no end. There's another story I'm writing that they're building up another element within the military, within the Army intelligence overseas, because they want to gather more intelligence. They want to do their own interrogation of captured Iraqi prisoners and take it away from the CIA.
But thousands
growth of, industry intelligence.
I understand, but it's also a very scary portent that you're revealing here, Walter Pincus.
I think it is enormously scary, and the reason I keep writing about it is because I think the public ought to be aware about it, and it's really the kind of thing Congress should rein in, but there really has not been a serious oversight hearing on the intelligence community since reorganization.
And the Rob Silverman committee report that began this Select Intelligence Committee, that was effectively the phase one, and we've been talking about phase two. Across the board, though, they talked about the strategic deficit in strategic thinking, and of course, you know, Iraq is an example of strategic blindness, where we've effectively strategically empowered Iran and moved Al Qaeda 1,000 miles closer to Europe. So, is there any sense? I mean, in a broad sense, you can't help feeling that here we are, just a week or so ago, they passed a record defense bill with almost no dissent within the Senate and the House, and we seem to be spending more on defense and intelligence than the rest of the world combined, but our deterrent value is going down, and our ability to deter our adversaries is diminished, and we're losing wars. We're losing Iraq, and it looks like we're beginning to lose Afghanistan.
Well, what you have to, underneath all this, is the whole question of what our policies are. And defense intelligence is there to inform policymakers. But it's the policymakers that can read the intelligence any way they want and use it either to push their own views or disregard it if it doesn't fit what it wants. One of the complaints in the pre-war Iraq period is that they just cherry-picked the intelligence, took the stuff that supported what they wanted to do, and left out the bad part. I just wrote a piece last week that came out thanks to this new report that the highest-ranking known intelligence source we had inside Saddam Hussein's cabinet, Najib Sabri, the foreign minister, actually gave us inside information in September of 2002. His information on weapons of mass destruction was that Saddam Hussein would like to have nuclear weapons, didn't have any, but did have chemical weapons, although apparently he was talking about the old ones. But he also said that Saddam Hussein was worried about Osama bin Laden, thought about him as an enemy, and that there were no contacts between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda The information on WMD, on the weapons, nuclear and chemical, went immediately to the White House in a very highly sensitive report that didn't go anywhere else. The information on the lack of a connection between Saddam Hussein and bin Laden didn't go to the White House, and we're still trying to find out why it didn't go.
Well, let's stay in touch then. There's obviously a lot more
this
questions
is the
to ask.
Industry.
I thank you so much for joining us, Walter Pincus.
It's nice talking to you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Walter Pincus, who's one of the country's leading national security reporters. He covers intelligence for The Washington Post. He's won a Polk Award, an Emmy, and a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. And let's now go to the subject of the showdown that's coming in the Senate this week between the president and a group of defectors, if you will, from the Republican, otherwise closed ranks of the Republican Party. John McCain of Arizona, Susan Collins, John Warner, the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Lindsey Graham joined the Democrats in rejecting the president's efforts to rewrite the Geneva Convention and the FISA Act. And I'm speaking with Glenn Greenwald, who's a constitutional lawyer, writes for Salon.com, and he has a very popular blog, Unclaimed Territory. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, How Would a Patriot Act? And he has written extensively of late on the Bush administration's attempts to retroactively immunize themselves from prosecution on both FISA and the War Crimes Act. And also Martin Lederman, who's a visiting professor at the Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches constitutional law. He is a former attorney advisor at the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel. He's written widely on questions relating to executive power, detention, interrogation, and torture. And much of his recent work can be found on the Balkanization website called Balkan, balkin.blogspot.com. Let's begin with Glenn Greenwald. Glenn, I know that there's talk of the CIA paying insurance for their agents who may well have already violated the law. In a broader sense, though, it's just disturbing to see this country's reputation abroad. Not just to take issue on a moral level, but even on a public relations level, it seems that we've become the United States of torture rather than the last best hope of mankind.
Well, I think that is probably the most important point, is even if you set the moral issues aside or the practical issues and the effect it has on our national security, it's the Bush administration which has defined this conflict as being one that will be resolved on the plane of ideas, and that winning hearts and minds and changing how the U.S. is perceived in the Middle East is, according to the Bush administration, the paramount determinant in whether or not we will make ourselves safer and prevail over Islamic extremism. And it's difficult to imagine something more detrimental to that goal than having a debate where the government's principal objective is to repudiate the Geneva Conventions, free itself from those mandates, and essentially give itself the ability to engage in acts that the world widely considers to be torture. It's whatever marginal benefit comes from the interrogation value, if there is any, is so vastly outweighed by what it does to the way in which we're perceived in the world that it's hard to believe there's even a debate.
And Martin Lederman, what do you make of it? Because as Glenn Greenwald just pointed out, it's hard to see that there was any the hit we've taken to our reputation and good name abroad clearly outweighs any actionable intelligence that's come. It seems that much of what happened at Guantanamo and these secret prisons has basically been it's just blindly scooping people up and without an end game. I mean, at the end of the day, there never seems to have been an end game in what's gone on.
I think from the administration's perspective, I'll try to give the perspective of the White House. There were two different sorts of detainees here that we're talking about applying these techniques to. And the one that's at issue now, and the one that was at issue at first and is once again in the spotlight, are a handful to somewhere a few dozen, but at least 14 high-level al-Qaeda operatives who have been detained and held at these black sites. And there are some people in the administration, by no means all, who believe that the intelligence that is gained from applying torture or torture-like techniques to these detainees helps them to both interdict future terrorist acts against the United States and its allies, and more importantly, I think from their view, identifies for them where other al-Qaeda leaders are so that those folks might be detained. So that is what the White House wants to be able to do.
But in effect, I don't know whether you saw the testimony with Senator Feinstein and Gonzalez, but much of what he was arguing, he said, you know, he had to admit that it would apply in wartime, and then he sort of said, well, we're not at war. Well, doesn't that undercut their whole case of the war on terror?
Well, I think there is a war of sorts. There's an authorized armed conflict against al-Qaeda and against the Taliban, but more importantly right now, Congress voted 518-1 to authorize the use of military force against al-Qaeda. It's not a war against terrorism. It's not a war against a technique or a form of warfare or crime. But it is an armed conflict that the military and the CIA is, in some sense, an outgrowth of the military, is authorized to use military force. Now, that does not include, in my view, the right to violate the Geneva Conventions. In fact, the court has held that Congress's intent was that the United States not violate the Geneva Conventions. And the problem that the administration has now is that the techniques they have been using do violate the Geneva Conventions, and so they need a new law to basically allow them to breach the Geneva Conventions.
Isn't that what Chief Justice Marshall's admonition was? Ours is a government of laws, not of men?
Well, they would write a new law which would supersede. From 2002 until today, that's what's been going on. The president has been asserting the right to ignore laws, either by construing them in implausible ways or by asserting a constitutional override. Now he's somewhat stuck in light of the Supreme Court's June decision. And so that is why he's now turning to the legal process and asking Congress to pass a law to allow him to violate the Geneva Conventions.
And Glenn, what isn't it clear that the JAGs are very uncomfortable with this? The military is very uncomfortable with this because they can see the obvious reciprocity if we say to the world we don't care about the Geneva Convention when our boys and girls get captured, then their fate is in extremely dubious hands. So it seems, and furthermore, President Bush's sort of cavalier speech the other day about secret prisons seemed to have caught the Allies by surprise, since they're left holding the bag.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the argument that there's a group of, you know, terrorists who are so inhumane and extreme, certainly al-Qaeda would qualify, that their treatment of our prisoners does not in any way depend upon what it is that we do. I don't think that, you know, there's a very compelling argument that our prisoners will be treated better by al-Qaeda if we adhere to the Geneva Conventions than if we don't. I think the important point is that how we conduct ourselves defines our moral authority in the world, defines the war that we are waging and what it is that we're fighting for. And I think that really is the issue, that we don't measure ourselves by saying that since al-Qaeda does it, we can do it too. We're the ones who insisted upon the Geneva Conventions and helped to create those standards, and that has been a central part of our national identity for the better part of a half a century. It's what made us a superpower that was respected in the world and not hated and feared. And the real danger from repudiating these values, I think, is that we lose that moral authority and all of the security that it provides us.
But surely this administration chose to fight the war on terror with soldiers, not with cops and spies.
Well, you're right, and you know, I think you know, you raise an interesting point too politically, which is that clearly what the administration was hoping for would be that Democrats would be standing up and trying to impede secret prisons and the use of torture, and what they found instead is that it's not only leading Republicans, but it's also substantial parts of the U.S. military who are concerned with not just how our soldiers are treated, but also how we're perceived in the world as well. And so the administration has really isolated itself into this extremist corner, and the intent to depict this as some sort of strong on terrorism versus weak on terrorism debate has been blocked, because really what it is a debate about whether we should fight the terrorists by complying with and adhering to our values, or whether we should relinquish them and become more like the terrorists.
And Martin Lederman, the obvious attempt on the part of the administration to make their recent behavior retroactively legal, how does this, what jeopardy do you see in terms of war crimes and the FISA court?
Well, putting aside the FISA court for a moment, and Glenn can certainly speak to that, this is one question on which I might diverge from Glenn. I think the prospects of retroactive prosecution for conduct that was undertaken between 2002 and the day of the Supreme Court's decision in June of this year is exceedingly unlikely, to the point of non-existent. I think that the Justice Department would never, at least domestic U.S. prosecution, the Justice Department would never go after CIA interrogators for doing things that the Justice Department had concluded were legal. I do think that as of this June, however, there would be very serious legal exposure if they continued to do these things, which is why our understanding is now that these techniques close to torture, and we should talk about what they are, have stopped pending the president's attempt to get them authorized once more by Congress.
But have they stopped in terms of contractors? Because there's no oversight over contractors, and contractors were doing much of the egregious activities at Abu Ghraib, Khaki being one of the contractors.
They were, and that's the other track that I mentioned at the outset. The first track was always the Central Intelligence Agency and its operations with respect to certain so-called high-level operatives, some of whom are high-level. The other was that Donald Rumsfeld and some of his aides at the Pentagon decided at some point that they wanted in on the intelligence gathering game too. And from all we can tell, they sent out both contractors and special operations forces, and at some point regular uniformed folks, to go ahead and start engaging in similar extreme and what the administration this morning called progressive interrogation tactics. And that led to, whether it was intended or not, it led to the sorts of abuses that we saw at Abu Ghraib, which was foreseeable for anyone who was thinking hard about this. And that seems to have stopped. The JAGs and the other career uniform military folks seem to have won the day within the Pentagon, and got their house in order, so that the new field manual expressly prohibits most of the conduct that the president now wants the CIA to be able to continue. So we have to hope, and I think Glenn would agree with me on this, that the Pentagon scandal is probably one of the past, at least until this legislation is resolved, and that right now the issue is the Central Intelligence Agency.
And Glenn Greenwald, what about the FISA court? Because I recall that some of the judges quit when they found out about the secret NSA programs, and it's worth noting that the administration kept feeding stuff to the FISA court. Obviously, because if they stopped feeding stuff to the FISA court, it would have been obvious they're up to something else. So it always struck me as rather cynical what they did.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, not only that, but they also had multiple opportunities to have courts rule on the legality of what it was that they were doing. And not only did they not seek those judicial rulings, they avoided them at every turn and are attempting still to avoid them. You see it with private lawsuits where anytime there's a lawsuit brought alleging that the program is illegal, they immediately try and avoid even arguing the merits of that and instead tell courts that they don't have authority to adjudicate these questions, because to do so would risk disclosure of state secrets. They could easily have, in any criminal case, said, here is evidence that we have obtained as a result of warrantless eavesdropping. And the question then would have been presented either to the FISA court, where they could have made an application for a warrant, or based on that kind of information, or even in the criminal court, the question would have been presented, is it legal, is it constitutional for the president to have been eavesdropping on Americans without warrants, and they've deliberately avoided that kind of judicial adjudication, and now they're trying to get the Specter bill passed, which would take all of those cases and put them all behind a secrecy wall in the FISA court and make it very difficult for those questions ever to be decided by a court.
And there are three bills, right? There's Specter, DeWine, and Feinstein.
Right. Specter and DeWine are more similar. They're the ones that really legalize warrantless eavesdropping. The Feinstein bill would strengthen the president's eavesdropping powers, make it easier to eavesdrop without warrants in the first instance, but require that all eavesdropping on American citizens only be done with judicial approval.
And Martin Lederman, I imagine in this coming week, in the debates in the Senate, we will hear what we've already heard, particularly from the Senate leader, Bill Frist, who has argued that he cannot abide the notion that we will be forced to provide evidence, you know, under the Constitution to the accused, secret intelligence evidence being handed over to the likes of Khalid Muhammad, you know, the architect of 9/11.
Yes, well, this gets to yet another issue. You've now raised a couple, and this is the question of when we try these people for war crimes, and the administration has finally decided that it's about time that we put on trial these al-Qaeda leaders. The fact that they've been engaged in these extreme interrogation techniques now has presented a problem, because the classified information in question that they don't want to reveal to the defendant or publicly during these trials is the nature of the interrogation from which they obtain some of the evidence that they want to introduce in order to convict these persons. And so it ties back to the interrogation scandal and the torture scandal, because I understand why they don't want to make public the manner in which we interrogated these folks. Perhaps that ought to be classified information as a general matter. So they've put themselves in quite a bind, because the evidence that they would use to convict these folks, and most of them probably deserve conviction, if not all of them, the evidence, however, is tainted by the fact that we use torture or other unlawful interrogation techniques to obtain it.
But the impression that Senator Frist and critics of particularly of the defectors within the Republican Party are probably resonate with the average person, that, you know, that giving away the crown jewels of national security to a terrorist.
Well, I tend to agree. I don't know how we would possibly introduce this evidence at the trial. But it's the Bush administration that's put itself in this bind, right? Mm-hmm. And the only way they see to get out of it is to convict people without letting them see the evidence against them, which is something very foreign to our notions not only of due process, but of basic fairness in trials. We don't typically accept show trials here in the United States, where there's one-sided presentation of evidence that the other side, the defendant, can't even address, let alone contradict or try to explain. I don't know offhand what the answer is to this, unless we have a public clearing and a public account of the interrogation techniques that we've used on these folks. Maybe we can convict even revealing that information. Maybe not. It'll be interesting to see if the administration doesn't get its way on this.
But Glenn Greenwald, surely the intelligence community has had a lot of experience with this dilemma. Trying Aldrich Ames. I mean, clearly he gave away the store. His trial, they didn't release all the obvious intelligence. They let him make a long statement, which was largely a political statement. But as far as I know, they've already gone down this path and preserved state secrets at the same time convicting people for treason, which is a pretty high bar to reach, I believe.
We Well, you know, I think you hit on what one of the issues that I consider to be the most important that runs through all these debates, which is, you know, things like the Geneva Convention and issues concerning, for example, FISA are things that are not new. They've restrictions that are imposed by FISA, for example, have been in place for 25 years. Multiple different administrations, including the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration, complied with FISA while gathering foreign intelligence and defeating the communist threat. And there's all sorts of other protections that we've accepted, including the Geneva Conventions, while dealing with all kinds of pernicious enemies. And really the argument that is being made now is an argument that says all of these guidelines and all of these restrictions and safeguards that we as a country have accepted and lived with for decades, now suddenly we need to throw them all away because although we could previously defend ourselves within its framework, we no longer can. And, you know, that is a debate that I think needs to be held a lot more explicitly and out in the open, that really what the administration is attempting to do is something quite radical, and that is to toss aside decades worth of values and protections and legal safeguards that we've always managed to live within, even while defeating very formidable enemies that the administration now claims it can no longer comply with.
Well, just in closing then, Martin Liederman, obviously we're entering the campaign season here, and it appears that that the White House is going to be pushing a Be Very Afraid campaign, and the president is actually going up in the polls. So what do you think will be the resonance of Colin Powell's letter to Senator McCain, where he supported the maintaining the Geneva Convention and said the world is beginning to doubt the moral basis of our fight against terrorism? So what's going to resonate, the president or people who have a more nuanced and humanitarian argument?
I suppose that both will resonate with different portions of the electorate, and I don't know exactly how it will play out in that handful or of a few dozen House seats and 6 to 7 Senate seats that are going to determine who controls the Congress come January. I think that both sides are both playing politics, but also acting according to what they see as principle. And I think the Colin Powell letter and similar letters from other well-respected generals and heads of the Joint Chiefs of Staff are having a profound effect on many swing votes within the Congress, notwithstanding the fears that it might have political ramifications. You know, my guess is as good as yours as to what's going to happen in these swing districts. I think, however, that what happens in November might end up determining what goes on in the last 2 years of the Bush administration with respect to the war against al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations.
I thank both Glenn Greenwald and Martin Liederman for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Glenn Greenwald, constitutional lawyer, writes for Salon.com, and Martin Liederman, visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and he's also a former attorney advisor to the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel. I'm now speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's a Nation Institute Puffin Foundation writing fellow, whose work appears regularly in The Nation and on Salon.com, Alternet, and The American Prospect and The Washington Monthly. And recently, as a little over a week ago, he did a major expose of the right-wing path to the ABC $40 million primetime path to 9/11, in which he revealed the evangelical and extremist cabal behind this project, how they snook at ABC into airing this propaganda, which was designed to help the Republican Party 2 months prior to the national election and pin 9/11 on Bill Clinton. And Max, have you been able to do a forensic investigation into the money trail?
Well, I actually called ABC and asked their vice president for media relations, which is the person who is, you know, designated to lie to me, where did the money come from? Was it ABC stockholders? Were conservative organizations funding this movie? Was it something even more sinister, you know, or was it, were corporations funding it? Who? And I you know, just received dead air on the line. And a secretary, you know, the assistant said that this vice president would call me back, and you know, with the answer. The answer never arrived. What I did hear, however, is that Robert Iger, the CEO for, you know, Disney's corporate wing and entertainment wing, read my article. I heard this from a source who's well acquainted with Iger, and he said he was deeply disturbed by what he read. Unfortunately, this was after the movie aired, and I, you know, this guy Iger, who oversaw the entire project, has been you know, privately reassuring everyone, you know, his most prominent critics, you know, including Bill Clinton, that he would edit these false scenes out that, you know, that depict Clinton, you know, willfully ignoring the threat from Al-Qaeda, Sandy Berger hanging up the phone on CIA agents who supposedly have bin Laden surrounded, who happen to be played by former New Kids on the Block. And, you know, in the end, he wound up editing 70 seconds out, and all of the false scenes were there. And in the second episode, Bush interrupted with one of his most politically divisive speeches of his administration. So I think what you had was one of the most severe right-wing propaganda spectacles, and it was all centering around, you know, probably one of the most tragic events in American history. I think this is a precursor to the campaign strategy the Republicans are going to employ. It's going to be more Machiavellian than anything we're used to.
So nobody at ABC noticed that the director and the writer was fated by the right-wing Hollywood crowd who feel, you know, put upon by the liberal cabal, by this, you know, this sort of these godless sodomites who run this town, that they have basically... He was their keynote speaker at their version of whatever the alternative.
Right.
And then you've got this Cunningham guy. His father is a right wing evangelical. Runs a Youth with a Mission. He forms the Film Institute, which, according to its mission statement, says is dedicated to a godly transformation and revolution, presumably to purge the godless sodomites from Hollywood. So, and if you go to the internet database and look at this Cunningham guy's credits, they're appallingly thin. So. Give us a break. I mean, nobody noticed this?
Yes. A month before, you know, I don't know if we're going to have time to spin out the whole, you know, network within the network here, I'm going to try and describe who the characters were behind this movie. The screenwriter is a guy named Cyrus Noriste, who also has a pretty thin bio himself. You know, he's a young guy. Maybe he's pretty talented.
Please, Max. It was the worst written, most puerile.
I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt.
No, but I saw the thing. Unbelievable dialogue. This grotesque caricature of Madeleine Albright saying there are diplomatic considerations. I mean, you know,
they actually had to correct the episode right before because they had spelled her name wrong. But this guy Cyrus Noriste, a month before the episode aired, he gave an interview to David Horowitz's Front Page Mag, saying, you know, basically explaining how the film was going to bash Clinton. And you know, Noriste is very close to David Horowitz. He's spoken at David Horowitz's Liberty Film Festival, and there, you know, he denounced Hollywood liberals, and they were feted by, you know, this is a festival that's been feted by the likes of, Holocaust denier enabler Christopher Hitchens, Newt Gingrich, Victor Davis Hanson, this, you know, third-rate historian, and Noriste was a speaker there. Not only that, the two co-founders of this conference were basically running interference for ABC as soon as the Democrats started criticizing the movie. So, you know, this blog, which I suspect is financed by David Horowitz because, you know, it's the official blog of the Liberty Film Foundation, was urging conservatives to write to ABC so that the film would air despite all the Democratic criticism. They were attacking Democrats as violating the First Amendment for their criticism. And meanwhile, the other co-founder, who's sort of a right-wing operative in Hollywood named Govindini Murthy, was all over the talk show circuit, all over cable news, defending this movie and defending Cyrus Noriste, who's her good friend who wrote this movie. Meanwhile, you have David Cunningham, the director, who comes from another sort of wing of the far shores of the conservative movement. This is a guy, he's the director of The Path to 9/11, and his father, Lauren Cunningham, was founded this Youth with a Mission organization, which has been described by former members as a cult, which practices brainwashing tactics. And they, you know, they aim to train youth to enter, you know, influential spheres of society and transform them and you know, inject them with, you know, biblical law. Lauren Cunningham was a student of Christian Reconstructionism. I know you've talked about this on your show before, Ian, and but just to explain to your listeners, Christian Reconstructionism is you know, one of the most extreme theologies of you know, evangelical Protestantism, and it aims to replace the Constitution with biblical law. That includes the laws of Leviticus.
Well, it goes back to their role model is Oliver Cromwell,
right? Which is a wonderful role model to have.
Let me just because I don't want to run out of time here, though, because
yeah.
I still want to get to the core issue here. Was we know that David Horowitz is funded by Richard Mellon Scaife.
Right.
And he's basically told all, he used to be on the left where there's no money, and he moved to the right where there's nothing but money from these bilious billionaires who want to protect their inheritance. And he, you know, basically has promised them that he'll transform Hollywood, just give me the money. And they throw money at him.
So, well, David Horowitz every week has a, you know, his Wednesday meeting in Hollywood,
right,
where they have you know, conservatives.
But did any of Richard Mellon Scaife's money end up in developing this project for ABC?
Well, that's the question, and what we can say for sure is Richard Mellon Scaife's money wound up you know, promoting this movie, because David Horowitz was so deeply engaged in the promotion of this movie and in defending this movie against criticism. You know, these two operatives who are all over cable news and who are organizing conservative letter-writing campaigns are almost certainly paid by David Horowitz, because the film festival they run is, you know, listed as a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, whatever that is, and that's funded by Richard Mellon Scaife, who funded, you know, all the attacks on Bill Clinton during the 90s, and, you know, right after 9/11, David Horowitz was the guy who spearheaded the, you know, conservative attempt to place the blame on Bill Clinton. He sent out thousands of flyers to media outlets that were prepared by his, prepared by his political machine, you know, explaining how Bill Clinton had allowed this to happen and how it was actually his fault and how Bush was behaving like FDR.
That's pretty much the way that the stupid movie was.
This movie is an extension of that strategy, that conservative strategy, and it came on the fifth anniversary, and it came during, you know, at the height of, you know, election season, and Bush, you know, it was timed so that Bush would interrupt the second episode with his speech telling Americans that, you know, the safety of their country depends on the battle in the streets of Baghdad, one of the most ludicrous statement.
Well, they also, just in terms of filmmaking, apart from the fact that it was the most trite, infantile script, the direction was so slanted, and they made such grotesque cartoons out of Berger and Albright. But conversely, Rice, they made up a whole scene where Rice, when Dick Clark says, he gives her the memo, Al Qaeda determined to strike in the United States, she says, oh, the president's forming a special task force to deal with Al Qaeda. I mean, which, is, as far as I know, is complete fiction. And then furthermore, they cut Bush in. Instead of showing him reading to the kids and then flying around for a couple of days like a chicken with its head chopped off, not knowing what to do, they cut to him several days later, but they put it in real time several days earlier after 9/11, where he makes a speech talking about Al-Qaeda. So it was just unbelievably flagrant propaganda. And again, ABC aired this without commercials. Somebody paid for the airtime. I can't believe that they ate the whole $40 million.
Well, if you think about, you know, how hypocritical it is, I mean, you know, this is Disney, and Disney refused to distribute Fahrenheit 9/11 because it was too political. CBS refused to air this Reagan special, which was probably equally crappy, but contained less, you know, falsifications than this because of one scene where Reagan, you know, sort of insinuates that it's the fault of homosexuals that they have AIDS. And, you know, that was consistent with his policy. But, you know, you just see the networks and the mainstream press, you know, they're still willing to capitulate to conservative pressure, but, you know, and at the same time, when conservatives want to spin 9/11 and air a complete piece of propaganda that's also just poorly done, you know, they're steadfast in standing by their conservative friends. And the reason for this, you know, in this specific case, is because of the Passion of the Christ. What I'm hearing from inside ABC is that that ABC had wanted to mimic the marketing success of the Passion of the Christ, which was marketed through churches and, you know, through this sort of parallel network. It wasn't, and it was one of the top grossing movies ever, and it was a very profitable movie. And they thought that if they distributed these DVDs of the path to 9/11 to people like Rush Limbaugh, right-wing radio hosts, right-wing bloggers, that they would parallel the success of the Passion of the Christ. And when the people from the Clinton Foundation and, you know, and liberal bloggers asked for the DVDs, they, you know, expressly refused to give them to them. And luckily, you know, the silver lining on this is that most Republicans like football better than crappy movies, and they wound up watching Monday Night Football instead of this movie. And this movie was a total flop. So maybe, you know, if Hollywood's all about profit and not about politics like I thought it was, you know, there won't be a repeat performance of this right-wing propaganda. But the damage was done, and 13 million people did watch it.
But, Max, there's a big difference between... You can't compare Michael Moore to this ridiculous path to 9/11 propaganda.
Well, Michael Moore says, I am who I am, you know.
Yeah, but it's a it's apples and oranges. Michael Moore, even though Disney turned him down, we're still talking about a motion picture that is put in theaters. People have the option of paying the $7 or $10. But television is different. Television is a public media where the stewards, I understand, nobody gives up your airtime to be hijacked by right-wing hacks. So,
right.
You know, so if this movie were in a theater, nobody would see it.
Well, this movie was filmed under the tightest secrecy. It was only known to members of Youth with a Mission and David Cunningham's film project within Youth for a Mission, which aims to transform Hollywood. It was called the Untitled History Project. The media was kept out of the loop, and then all of a sudden it appears on TV on a major network, and it's a blatant piece of right-wing propaganda. I don't see any problem with conservatives having movies out, and I don't see any reason to protest their movies the way that they tried to actually take Michael Moore's movie out of movie theaters. And at the same time, I don't think that they should get away with having films that parade as documentary on major TV networks, and without, you know, any, you know, counterbalance, and with Bush interrupting the film to put his spin on 9/11, you know, this was, you know, just something I don't think we've seen before. But like I said, it's a precursor to the strategy that they're going to employ in the days, you know, getting, you know, as we get closer and closer to November. This is what their attack ads are going to look like.
Well, just in closing, then, it seems to me that if ABC is trying to get the Mel Gibson audience from this S&M movie that he made, the Passion of the Christ, if they want to target that audience and they're going to allow, you know, the Mel and Scapes of this world to generate propaganda through these sort of Hollywood brown shirts out here, then why not progressives starting to boycott ABC Disney?
Well, I think you bring up a good question. What should be the progressive response to this? And I think the progressive response was totally reactive and not proactive, and that was a disaster. You know, this is the fifth anniversary of 9/11. Progressives should have been preparing their own argument to explain Bush's failures surrounding 9/11. You know, but that, you know, maybe there were 10 minutes of dead air after the path to 9/11. Maybe progressives could have bought that dead air and aired Bush reading My Pet Goat in, you know, for 6 minutes, just sitting there reading My Pet Goat while the second plane headed to the World Trade Center, or explaining how Bush, you know, when he heard that a plane was headed to the Pentagon, he headed to Florida, or then he headed to Nebraska, then he headed to Shreveport, Louisiana, and 4 days later he finally wound up in New York and grabbed that bullhorn. So
right.
I just don't think there was any proactive effort on, you know, the part of progressives. It was all complaints, and so I think progressives should rethink that, you know, ahead of the 2008 election, that there has to be a you know, that they have to use their power, you know, in the film industry, in the publishing industry, and elsewhere, to make this argument to Americans that Bush did nothing in 9/11.
We've run out of time, Max Blumenthal. I thank you for joining us, and I hope you stay on top of ABC and finally get some kind of accounting of who paid for this film and who paid for the airtime, since they ran it commercial free. I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Max Blumenthal, Nation Institute Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow, writes for American Prospect, Nation Magazine. And I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer, and special assistants on this program. I thank Tom Payne.